Boker Tov, everybody. Pleasure to welcome you all back to part two of Nechama Price's Shiurim on the leadership of Am Yisrael on the Truach Shvatim. Last week was on Reuven. This week we'll go to Yehuda. This she'll post the source sheet. It's on the website already. I sent them a link, and we can get started right away. Bevakasha, it's all yours.
Okay. Hi, everybody. I'm just going to share a screen.
Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Good morning, everyone. Thank you all for joining me for our part two of our Leadership Tribes of Israel series. It is based on my book, I just came up called Tribe of Blueprints. I encourage you all to buy it. It's on all 12 tribes, and of course, includes so much more than what we can do in 1 hour. But what I wanted to move to today is, of course, the tribe of Judah, who, I'll tell you a secret, is my favorite of all 12 tribes. After analyzing all of them for years, I'm such a fan of the Yehuda character, not just in Bereishit, but also throughout the rest of Tanakh. I wanted to start with the following question, which I guess is going to help us in terms of comparing last week's share to this week's share. Is both Yehuda and Reuven come from Leah? They are both the sons of Leah. And we spent a lot of time last week discussing the relationship of Yaakov and his wives, how he very much prefers Rachel to Leah. And therefore, the question I have to ask, since in so many ways the issue that we have with Reuven is all based.
Nechama, hold on 1 second. Yeah, there's a little echo in the sound. I'm not sure why that's happening, but you know what? I'm gonna mute everybody and then unmute you. You'll speak. Hopefully that will fix the problem. Hold, give me a second.
Sure.
Okay, unmute yourself. And hopefully they'll find. I don't know if it was sometimes. I don't know if the way how close you were to your computer. But if you speak now, I'll let you know how it is.
Is it better?
I think so. I hope so. Yes.
Yes. Yes. Your chat's coming. I can't see the chats.
Yeah. I'll monitor all the chats. I'll monitor.
Okay.
Them. You can go ahead.
All right. Let me know though. Please stop me. I can move the computer if need
so
be.
So far, so good. Believe I'm Mara. It's working. Okay.
Amazing. Okay. So picking up where I left off, last week we saw very clearly that Reuven was affected by the relationship of Yaakov with his mother. What we're going to see is that Yehuda is going to become the leader of the family. So the question that we really have to ask is, how is there such a difference between Reuven and Yehuda? And of course, the simple answer is their personalities are different. We all have kids with lots of different personalities. Have two kids born to the same parents who are totally different. But I also believe that the situation is very different by the time Yehuda is born. Yehuda is child number 4. If you look with me at source number 1, I review with you the sentiment that Leah gives over when she's naming her children. Last week we saw that she names Reuven. Why? Ki ra'ah Hashem ba'ani ki ataya ben mishi. God heard my torture. I am not loved by my husband. Maybe now that I have a child, my husband will love me. She is depressed. She is upset. She is hoping that Reuven will fix her situation. Child 2 is born, Shimon, and the answer is no, it didn't work. Ki shama Hashem, but then child 3 is born, Levi. Hapam yovei ishi alai. There's hope again. Maybe now my husband will come to me. Ki aladiti lo shlosha banim, because I gave him son. Because when Yehuda is born, her attitude is very different. Hapam odeh et Hashem. This time I thank God. It is possible that she's happy now because she has 4 children. Or maybe one could argue she's happy now because her situation with Yaakov has changed. There's other reasons in the Psukim to possibly argue that as well. If you look at source number 2 with me, when God allows Leah to have children, the Pasuk says, Vayar Hashem kisnua Leah. God saw that Leah was hated, and therefore, Vayivtach et Rachma, he allows her, he opens her womb, he allows her to have children, but Rachel akara, but Rachel is barren. There's 2 ways to understand the Pasuk. Number 1, Rachel is barren, Leah is not. Leah is able to have children naturally but again, God is the one who allows us to have children. So it's written as God opened her womb, meaning God allowed her to have children. However, there's another explanation brought down by the Radak, brought down by Barbanel and others, which is here in source two. Vayivtach milamed shehayta akara v'Hashem patach et rachma, meaning she was barren just like her sister. However, Hashem, because he saw that she was hated, decided to allow her to be able to have children. Because she's hated, he miraculously allowed a barren woman to have children. Therefore, very telling, I do a pasuk there again in verse 3, right after Yehuda is born, the pasuk tells us, Vatamod meledet, she stops having children. And therefore, the whole reason why God is allowing her to have children is because she's hated. Possibly one could argue that the reason why now all of a sudden he doesn't allow her to have children, possibly reversing her back to being barren, is because the situation is she is no longer hated. Not only that, we see a change in Rachel. If you look at source number 4 with me, for the first time after Yehuda is born, Vatikane Rachel bachota, Rachel is jealous of her sister. And you have to ask, why wasn't she jealous after child number 1 or child number 2 or child number 3? Rachel has no children. Shouldn't she be jealous the entire time? So one could argue there was something about the birth of Yehuda. When the birth of Yehuda happened, things changed within the home. And because things changed within the home, Rachel changed as well. All of a sudden, she becomes jealous. All of a sudden, she approaches Yaakov and says, Havali banim, you have to give me children, I'm going to die. And his reaction is different than ever before. Pasuk Bet here in source 4, Vaycharaf Yaakov Rachel, he gets mad at Rachel and he talks out to her in a seemingly very insensitive way. The relationship of Yaakov and Rachel is seeming. So you have to start to wonder, is it just Leah's happier? She has all these children and that inspires some sort of difference in the personality of Rachel. She starts to see her sister so happy and she has all these kids and therefore gets a little bit upset. Or is it that the relationship of Leah has changed? After having four child, maybe for the first time, he's more time. He's giving her his attention. He's loving her much more, and therefore his relationship with Rachel starts to change. Rachel yells at him, Rachel gets jealous, and he, of course, gets angry right back. This two ways of looking at the story is reflected in the Mefarshim here in source number 5 and 6. Rashi, who says it's about the fact that Leah's happy now, even comes up with this idea found in Chazal, Shenatalti Yoter Michalki, I have to expose. According to Chazal, they knew they were supposed to be children. Somehow she also knew already there was going to be four wives. And therefore, when she has four, she knows she has more than she's really supposed to have. And therefore, she's happy. Therefore, I'm going to be happy. I'm going to praise. I'm going to thank Hashem. But it's about the children. Or Abarbanel here in source 6. Remember Abarbanel last week was who said Yaakov hated Leah, like really hated her, was mean to her with his language, with his actions.
So we were discussing how the situation has changed in the house of Leah, how possibly she is feeling loved by Yaakov. And then we're discussing, therefore, Yehuda's situation being different. He's not seeing his mom sad. He's not seeing his mom feeling unloved by their dad. But not only that, one could argue, he doesn't have the same issues with his father as his other brothers. Reuven, we know, already gets in trouble with his dad in Perek Lamed Hey, Vayishkav et Bilha, as we discussed last week. We have Shimon and Levi, who get in trouble with their dad in Perek Lamed Dalet with the story of Dinah and Shechem. And therefore, he's possibly the favorite child of Leah in his dad's eyes, the only kid that hasn't really done anything wrong. However, when we first hear really about Yehuda, besides his birth, is if you have the source sheet, source number 7, which is the story of Mechirat Yosef. And what's clear in that story is he is the brother everyone listens to. The story concludes, Vayishme'u Achav, and the brothers listen to Yehuda. His plan is followed, not because he's the oldest brother, not because he's the favorite brother, but because he's the natural leader brother. Everybody listens to Yehuda. But if I look at the story, and this is source 8, if you have the source sheet one more time, I actually see that there are three ideas within the psukim. The first idea comes up in Pasuk Yetet, where one brother, we don't know who, though Chazal believe that this is Shimon and Levi, Luchu v'nahargev v'nishecheu b'chayu barot. Idea number one, kill Yosef. Yosef is coming out to the field. He's no longer protected by his father. Idea number one, kill him. Idea number two is given by Reuven, a number of psukim later in Pasuk Chaf Aleph and Chaf Bet. Let's throw him into the boar. Let's throw him into the pit. Now, Reuven privately, as we discussed last week, assumes that he's going to save Yosef at the end. But remember, to the brothers, the idea is throw him in the pit for him to die in the pit of starvation or of an animal that will come in and kill him, but kill Yosef in the pit. The third idea comes from Yehuda. Yehuda says, let's sell him. And that's the one the brothers listen to. So if I think about it from Yehuda's side, there's two ways to understand Yehuda. I can actually look at Yehuda as the hero here of the story. It's the nicest of the three options. Kill him, let him die in a pit, or save his life by selling him to the Ishmaelim where he's allowed to live. If you look at source 9, if you have it in front of you, the Abarbanel says, this is Sikat Yehuda. He's the righteous one in the story. The ending where I bolded, Histadlut Hatzilo Miyadam B'mechirat Olam Mitzrayim. He was trying to save Yosef by selling him. He wasn't trying to hurt Yosef. The brothers wanted to kill him. He came along to save. So you might say, wait a second, Yehuda, if you want to save Yosef, why don't you just say to the brothers, don't hurt Yosef? Why do you have to sell him as a slave? So you could say Yehuda also didn't like Yosef so much and wanted to get rid of him. You could say, which we'll continue to see, that Yehuda was very smart in manipulating people, and he realized the brothers were too riled up. They weren't going to do nothing. So he had to come up with a more peaceful possibility of what to do to Yosef. Or three, maybe he realized that if he allowed Yosef to return home, if he wasn't there, one day the brothers might actually really hurt Yosef. The only way to save Yosef is to get him out of the house, away from all the rest of the brothers permanently, because Yehuda can't protect him forever. So it is possible that we see from this story, Yehuda's the good guy. Yehuda's trying to protect Yosef. Yehuda doesn't feel threatened by him and his favorite status. Yehuda just wants to help him. Or I can argue the opposite. If I look at the three suggestions, let's kill him, you have to question, would the brothers really have actually killed Yosef, or were they just kind of talking that way? Ooh, let's kill him, but they didn't mean it. Throw him in the pit. We know Reuven intended to save him. Yehuda's really the only plan where you can't undo it. Once you sell him, he's gone, and you can't get him back. So maybe Yehuda here is the bad one. And therefore, as Rashi points out, the brothers get mad at him. Source 10, if you had said, you had told us to sell him, we listened to you. If you had said to bring him back home, we would have listened to you too. So therefore, maybe here in this story, Yehuda is not the good one. But what we do see about Yehuda is he's the one they listen to. He's the one they possibly blame at the end. And what we also see about Yehuda, which is something we will see throughout, he's never the first one to step up. He always allows other people to step up first. He doesn't want to lead. It's not like he's like, oh, I'm the leader of the brothers. I need to get questions like Reuven does. He allows other people. But normally when he speaks, everyone listens. And therefore, he's the natural leader of the brothers all the way from the beginning. I move from here to Perek Lamed Chet. Perek Lamed Chet is the story of Yehuda and Tamar. It's a private story about Yehuda and his family. And there are also two very different ways to look at Yehuda, but the personality I want to bring out from the story itself. If you're, again, on the source sheet, which I see now is on the chat, so please print it or look at it on your screen if you can. But again, if you have a Tanakh, you can even open it, which will be helpful as well. If we start off the story.
You can try to share your screen. It should work from your computer. I'm not sure. I don't want to mess up things, but that might work. But yes, everybody can print or go. And it's on our website also if you can't get it from the chat box. Otherwise, yeah, so.
It's shared. So yeah, let's see if that messes up. I unshare if it messes up my ability to be heard.
If it does, I'll let you know and we'll unshare and people will do it through themselves. Okay, thanks.
Sounds great. Source number 11. The story begins with, this is immediately after the selling of Yosef in the Psukim, possibly not chronologically, but in the Psukim, where Yehuda vayered Yehuda me'etachav, he leaves his brothers. If I want to look at this in a negative way, I could say Yehuda does a yirida, going down in level, going away from the morals of his family, leaves his family, and meets up with a guy by the name of Chirah, someone who does not have good morals, who leads him to prostitution by the end of the story. This is a negative story story we're about to hear about Yehuda. And if you look at source number two, at Rashi, one could look at it in a little bit of a different way. Not that Yehuda says, oh, I reject the values of my family, but it's that to some extent the family rejects him. We went with your lead, we listened to what you said, things didn't go the way that we wanted to. Rashi, the brothers are like, wait, we don't want to listen to you anymore. Look what happened. Look how sad our father is. And Yehuda feels rejected. Yehuda feels lonely and goes to find himself another family. So too possible source 13, the Chizkuni, he couldn't handle looking at his dad every day. He was so sad and so broken by what happened because Yosef was sold. And therefore, it's possible to look at this story, I would say, in two ways. Either we're starting out with a Yehuda who is rejecting the values of his family, or we have a Yehuda who's sad, who's lonely, who's broken by the fact that what he has did to his dad and the family maybe even rejecting him. Or I could look at the story in a very different way. Yehuda, this is a story of Yehuda growing up and leaving his family, like all people do, to get married and to have children. This is not a negative story, at least to start, of Yehuda. This is just a story about Yehuda growing up and getting married. And chronologically, it actually makes more sense that he leaves his family to have this new family, right, to have a wife and to have children way earlier than the story of selling of Yosef. So here we go. Yehuda leaves the family for numerous reasons, and he gets married to a woman. We don't know her name, but her dad is named Shua, and he's a Kanani. And here again, I could look at it in two ways. Yehuda, who is messing up, leaving the morals of his family, marrying a woman from Canaan. We know that the forefathers are Avram would not let Yitzchak, and Yitzchak did not want Yaakov to marry a woman from Canaan. And here Yehuda leaves his family and marries a woman from Canaan. Right, and Radak here, I gave you in source 14, I'm going to move faster because I know we lost some time here. Radak, who points out that of course the children of Yaakov were not allowed to marry women from Canaan either. And therefore here is a story of Yehuda doing something very wrong. Or I can argue, as do some of the Mefarshim, that this is not an issue at all. Rather, don't learn it out to be, as Radak points out in the beginning, that she's from Canaan, but rather, it's a Canaan here means Socher. It means he was a merchant. He wasn't from Canaan. Yehuda, of course, didn't marry somebody from the land of Canaan. Or one could argue that we never hear the Shvatim being told they're not allowed to marry someone from Canaan. So again, I take a step back. Is this a story of Yehuda rejecting the values of his family, leaving us and marrying a woman from Canaan against the values of the Jewish people? Or is it that he's just simply growing up, marrying a woman who he's totally allowed to marry? The story continues in source 15. His two sons mess up. His two sons do something ra b'nei Hashem, which is bad, and his two sons are killed. In this, again, I can see two ways to look at it. His two sons mess up and do something wrong. This reflects on Yehuda, his new values. He does something wrong. Therefore, his children are brought up that way. They do something wrong. We blame Yehuda for instilling terrible values in his son. As I gave you here a pasuk from Shmuel Aleph, how we blame Eli to some extent for the values of his son, Chafni and Pinchas, because he doesn't rebuke them, and therefore Eli is to blame as well. Do I look at Yehuda that way? We're hitting this low in Yehuda, having a terrible, horrible family. Or do we say as follows, that maybe it's something else? If we look at Rashi here in source 16, it's very clear from the text of the story that the second son, Onan, his mistake is in the bedroom, right? His sin is in the bedroom. He doesn't want to sleep with Tamar because he doesn't want to fulfill the mitzvah of Yibam. He doesn't want to have a child in the name of his brother. Comes Rashi based on Chazal and says, you know what? Er did the same mistake. Er also, the sin was in the bedroom, and it's because he wanted to leave her for beauty purposes. He didn't want her to get pregnant. And therefore, one could argue very strongly, this is something Yehuda could have never known. Yehuda couldn't have rebuked his son. Yehuda really is not to blame here in the story at all. As pointed out, source 17 by the Ramban, this story happening to Yehuda had nothing to do with being a punishment for what happened with selling of Yosef. This is a story unto itself about the terrible actions of his own children. And then I relate him to this pasuk in Bamidbar, to the children of Aaron, who we don't blame Aaron for the death of Nadav and Avihu. We feel bad for Aaron. So I start the story questioning. Do I blame Yehuda? Do I feel bad for Yehuda? What do I do with the story of Yehuda? The story then continues and takes a really kind of wild turn, because as we know, as the story goes on, we now have this daughter-in-law, Tamar, who's supposed to marry his third son, Shelah, and he doesn't want her to marry Shelah. Now, you can yell at Yehuda and say, Yehuda, you're a terrible person here in this story, right? If you look at source 20, Ki Rata, Ki Gadal, Shelah, Vihilo, Nasnalo, Veisha, Shelah's old enough to marry her. He's leaving her in this terrible status of an aguna. She can't marry anyone else. Yehuda is really messing up in this story. Or do I say, I totally get Yehuda. Yehuda's protecting his youngest son. As Rashi points out, he thinks she's a jinn. He thinks there's something wrong with her. He marries, Tamar marries Er, he dies. He marries Onan, he dies. The sin's in the bedroom. He doesn't know his sons are messing up. Of course he wants to protect Shelah. The Ramban, I'll say it quickly here, in source 22 is this fabulous idea where Yehuda actually doesn't mess up at all. Yehuda says, you know what, Er and Onan, something went wrong between them and Tamar, probably because they got married really young and they're really immature, and therefore they must have done something wrong because of their immaturity. So says the Ramban, I'm going to wait with Shelah. I want Shelah to grow up a little more so he could become more mature, and then maybe he won't do the same wrong action as Er and Onan. So all Yehuda was doing was saying to Tamar, wait, but I'll call you. And he really was going to call her. However, she sees Shelah's around the same age as the other two, and she loses patience, and therefore she comes out and, as we know, meets Yehuda on the street and has relations with him instead. But really, Yehuda was doing nothing wrong. So again, the beginning of the story, I see Yehuda in two ways, an overprotective, sad father who's lost two sons trying to protect his third. Or is this, he's really gone down in level, Yehuda, into this low, low moment of being cruel to Tamar. The story then takes a very strange turn where Tamar gives up on having patience on Yehuda, dresses up as a prostitute, and finds Yehuda, and Yehuda sleeps with Tamar. Now, if I want to look for bad Yehuda, that's obvious. I mean, that just seems like a very low, bad thing for him to do, something that really is not a moral act for one to do. But if I want to rationalize Yehuda, I want to understand Yehuda a little more, I could say as follows. First of all, in the psukim, it's very clear, source 23, he thinks she's a zona, right? He thinks she's a prostitute. He does not think he's sleeping with his daughter-in-law, even offers her, you know, something in return for her services. This is clear that he thinks she's a prostitute. Number two, source 24, his wife just died. So let's take Yehuda. His wife died. He's lost two sons. He thinks he's about to lose his third son if he marries him off to Tamar. And the pasuk tells us it's the time of the shearing of the sheep. Vayala goes zaytzono, which I gave you here a pasuk in Shmuel Aleph of another story of the shearing of the sheep where people get drunk. He was probably a little drunk. He probably made very, very sad in his situation. And he makes a very terrible, terrible error. Now, I am not coming here to say that what Yehuda did was correct in any sort of way. But I do want to point out here in source 25, going to a zona was a little bit more common in the times of Tanakh as something that was not looked at in the way.
About 5 seconds.
You lost me? Hello?
Now we hear you.
Okay. Am I good?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll hold it to my face. The way that Tanakh looks at going to a zona before Matan Torah is a little bit different than the way that we do. If you look here in source 25, we have the story of the two spies that Yehoshua sends to Eretz Yisrael going to the house of Rechav, the zona. We have Yiftach, who's one of our judges, who's a child of a zona. And we have Shimshon, one of our judges, who goes to a zona. I gave you here in source 26 the Abar Benel, who says pre-Matan Torah, there was really nothing wrong with the action of Yehuda at all, quoting the Mor Nevuchim of the Rambam, who says the same. So one could argue here, Yehuda actually doesn't do anything wrong. However, of course, within this story, I'm going to skip 27, Yehuda is very embarrassed. This is not something that Yehuda would normally do. We know very clearly from the end of the story, source 28, he sends the money to pay her with a friend. He doesn't want to go back to find her. And when the friend can't find her, he's like, let her keep my stuff. I mean, this is something that makes Yehuda very, very embarrassed. This is not a typical thing for Yehuda at all. The ending of the story, whether I look at Yehuda as this low, sad moment, or really more of a corrupt moment, an immoral moment of Yehuda, the ending of the story is really quite interesting. Because he finds out that Tamar is, of course, pregnant. Source 29, Zantat Tamar, she is pregnant, and she was supposed to be waiting for Shelah. He does not know at that moment that it's him who is the father, and therefore he says, let's kill her. And you again can look at this from two different ways. Yehuda doing something so wrong. I mean, he's punishing her so harshly for an action that he did. Or is it that she deserved this? This is the fate that she really deserves. Rashi points out she's the daughter of, she comes from shame, so her punishment should be stronger. Or the Ramban here who points out that she really, the way that it worked in those days is that if a woman did such an action, the husband or the father of the husband got the decision of what to do to this woman, therefore he was very justified. So if I take the story of Yehuda and Tamar, yes, I could see Yehuda in a few ways. He has a low moment. He certainly messes up in the story. I could see him more of a sad, broken man who loses his entire family and really makes a bad decision. Or I could see him as falling off the wagon after experiencing this terrible experience with Yosef and selling of Yosef for a moment. But where I really learn from Yehuda is the ending of the story here in Source 30, 31, and 32. Because normally when somebody hits such a low in their life, when somebody really messes up in such a terrible way, it's very hard to pull yourself out. It takes a lot of strength to pull yourself out. And here's where you see the true strength of Yehuda. Because what Yehuda does, number one, in Source 30, is he doesn't deny, right? As Tamar's being taken to be killed, she says, whose stuff is this? Is the father. He recognizes the stuff, but he could have denied it. Understand, they're in public. She is being burnt in the stakes. I'm sure there were tons of people there. I'm sure his dad was there. His brothers were there. How embarrassing for Yehuda to admit to this. He could have said, I don't know what she's talking about. That's not my stuff. Let's kill her. But instead, he stands up, admits his mistake in public. But not only that, he doesn't take advantage of it. He doesn't say, okay, great, now I have a nice young wife. He does not be with her anymore after this. But to me, Source 31 is actually the most powerful point about Yehuda, because what Yehuda could have done is sent her away. Yehuda could have said, you know what? I want nothing to do with you anymore. You're an embarrassment to me. These children are an embarrassment to me. But we see here in Source 31, when we're counting the Shivim Nefesh, the 70 people go down to Mitzrayim, we see that Yehuda's children, among them is Peretz and Zeresh, the twins that are born to Tamar. We see that instead of him saying, go away, sending him away like Ishmael, he keeps them. He raises them as his family. And of course, Source 32, as we read on Shavuot in the Megillas Rus, that from Peretz, from this child that's born to him and Tamar, comes David HaMelech himself. And therefore, in this story, you see a low in Yehuda. You see a flaw in Yehuda. Certainly, women is going to be a flaw throughout Tanakh. But you also see the strength of Yehuda, the Yehuda who's able to pick himself up and make the best of the situation at the end, admit to his mistake, and move forward. I want to now move to the next story, which I think is a powerful tshuva story of Yehuda. Because Yehuda doesn't step up for Yosef the way he's supposed to. Yehuda doesn't think about how his father's going to react if Yosef is sold. And therefore, when it comes to the next son of Rachel, Yehuda acts completely differently. We all know the story. The brothers go down to Mitzrayim. They face Yosef. They don't know it's Yosef. And he says to them, if you want to come back ever again, you need to bring down Binyamin. Now the brothers come home. As we discussed last week, Reuven says, I'll do it. I'll take control. And his dad says, no way. I don't trust you at all. Comes Yehuda and acts very, very differently. You see, Yehuda lets Reuven step up first. For sure he does, because Yehuda doesn't look to be the leader. But at the end of the day, Yehuda's always the leader, and he's much, much smarter and thought out than Reuven. The first thing we see right away in Source 33 is that he doesn't speak up right away. He waits. He waits kasher kilu lechol tashever. He waits till they run out of food. He knows that once they have food, the dad's not going to let them. Yaakov's never going to let them go down with Binyamin. It's never going to happen. So why waste his breath? He's going to wait till things are dire, till things are getting scary within the house to approach his father. The second thing we see is that just like Reuven, Yaakov says no to Yehuda. In Pasuk Gimel, Yehuda speaks to Yaakov and says, let me take Binyamin. And you know what? Yaakov says no. But what does Yehuda do that's different than Reuven? He tries again. He doesn't give up. Pasuk Chet, he tries again. And this time when he tries again with a different method. What we see in Yehuda is that he really knows how to manipulate people. He really knows how to get what he wants. And when it comes to his father, and when it comes later to Yosef as well, as we will see, he starts off one path. If he sees it's not working, he'll flip to a different path. The first time he tries to be rational with his father, you know, we need food. If you don't let me go, we're going to run out of food. The dad does not respond to that at all. But then he comes with a different method. And if you look here in Bereishis Mem Gimel Tet, his method is to be more threatening. His method is, no, that's not what I'm looking for here. His method is to say, we're all going to die if you don't let us come down. If you look at the difference between what he says and what Reuven says, it's very, very different. When it comes to Reuven, it's my two sons can die if I don't bring back Binyamin. Yehuda is, v'chatati l'cha kol yamim. I will take responsibility, Dad. You can trust me. I will take responsibility because if you don't let us go, v'nechyeh v'lo namut. We will all die. You have to let us go down. Yehuda is harsher. Yehuda is stronger. And Yehuda gives a better deal. Not that you'll hurt your grandchildren, but rather I will personally take responsibility. And not only does he say it in a way that makes Yaakov believe in him and trust him, we see from the end of the story, he lives up to his word. If Yehuda says something, Yehuda will do it. Yehuda, at the end, even offers himself off to Yosef because he promised his dad, v'chatasi l'cha kol hayamim. The leadership qualities of Yehuda are so clear from the story. He's strong, he's thought out, he's trustworthy, trusted by his brothers, trusted by his father, and he fully pulls through. Because when we get to the story in Mitzrayim, where Yosef ends up wanting to take Binyamin because the goblet is found in Binyamin's bag, the way Yehuda stands up for Binyamin is really quite remarkable. First of all, source 35, if you look at the psukim, when they're coming to Yosef after the goblet's discovered, Vayavo Yehuda ve'echav, all of a sudden Yehuda takes that leadership role. All right, here I'm going to stand up now. It's Yehuda and the brothers. Yehuda standing up, Yehuda's doing it first. And at first, as I said to you, he always tries method one, and if it fails, method two. He starts off in Pasuk Tet Zayin, what can I say? Very flattering, we'll be your slave. We're so sorry, for sure nothing. This couldn't have been what he did. And Yosef doesn't budge at all. So then he starts method two. This is Yehuda. He knows how to be strong. He knows how to be fearless. And he knows how to manipulate someone. Starting in Pasuk Yichet, Vayigash Elav Yehuda, he gets into Yosef's face. He's not on the floor anymore. He's not bowing to him anymore. He goes in his face, and he tries method two. Now, if you read through the Psukim, which we certainly don't have time to go through all of them, but I encourage you to, he creates a story for Yosef. And the story that he creates for Yosef is fantastic because it's not true. It's actually not true at all, but that's the genius of Yehuda. He starts off flattering, so he like takes Yosef's, you know, anger out. Ki kamocha kaparo, you're like paro. And then he goes on to blame Yosef. This is all your fault. Adonisha Alat Avadav, you asked us, do we have a dad? Do we have a brother? Search the psukim. Yosef never asks them anything. We told you that if we bring down Binyamin, it'll kill our dad. They never say that. They just say we have a younger brother that is at home. We told you how terrible it was going to be. If you look here in source 36, V'nomar l'adani, we told you, lo yuchal hanar la'azov et aviva, zavet aviva, mate, if the boy leaves the dad, he's going to die. They never say any of this. Yehuda is assuming that Yosef does not remember their past conversation. Yehuda is assuming that he can pull on Yosef's heartstrings of, you're going to kill my dad. If you look through the entire speech, he never mentions Binyamin by name. He calls him the boy the entire time. The entire speech is about how terrible it will be for our father if you take this boy away. Ki shnayim yodali ishti. We told you that there was only two sons to the wife. They never said any of these things, and therefore you're going to cause the death of our father. And he even brings it home by Pasuk Lamed, V'nafsho k'shur b'nafsho. Their souls are so connected. We told you all of this. Our father's going to die. Look back. They never say any of those words. What is Yehuda hoping? First of all, that Yosef won't remember the conversation. But Yehuda is hoping very strongly that he can manipulate Yosef. He flatters him, and then he puts the blame on him. It's not don't take Binyamin because he's innocent. It's don't take Binyamin because if you do, you will kill a man. And you're not a murderer. So we would like to give you a way to not murder our father. And you might ask, why did Yehuda think this was going to work? It's genius. And it's fearless, by the way, because he could get caught in his lies. And you could argue it's the only method he had. It's the only thing he could think of. Or you could realize that he picked up on the fact that Yosef is a very emotional person and that Yosef seems to care about their father. When they come down, the first thing that Yosef asks the second time, Hashalom Avicham Hazakein, how's your dad? He seems to care about Yaakov. And Yehuda doesn't know why, because he doesn't know it's Yosef. He's like, oh, he cares about my dad. He seems to care about the old man. Maybe I'm going to use that against him. Not only that, when he sees Binyamin for the first time, he goes into the room to cry. He sees that Yosef's emotional. He sees that there's emotion in him. So he thinks, maybe I can crack him. Maybe I can get him to do the impossible. He has all the power in the world. I have nothing. But maybe I could get him to let Binyamin go home. And of course, at the end, when he says to Yosef in Source 37, take me instead of the boy, that's the ultimate. That's the ultimate sacrifice of Yehuda. That's the ultimate thing that one could do. Yehuda is reliable. If I say I'm going to bring Binyamin home, I'll do everything I can to bring Binyamin home. He's totally different than Reuven. He's completely trustworthy. He's fearless, and he'll do anything to follow through on what he says he's going to do. And therefore, you clearly see here, whether he's not perfect, but you see here leadership qualities, which are tremendous and which are needed in every single leader. And therefore, it's not a surprise in Source 39, he's chosen to lead the family once again. When Yaakov is going down to Mitzrayim, he sends Yehuda in front to set up what is needed in the land. Rashi gives two interpretations, set up the physical land or set up the spiritual land. But whatever it is, why is Yehuda chosen? Rabbeinu Bachaye, Lefishu Hagibor V'Hazariz Mishar Echav. Because he is the strongest and he has all the leadership qualities much more than his brothers. And therefore, he is the leader of the family. And therefore, with all of the flaws and the whole story with him and Tamar, it doesn't matter. Yaakov chooses him to be the leader of the Jewish people. Source number 40 in his bracha to him, Yishtachavu lecha b'nei avicha, your brothers will bow down to you. Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda, kingship is going to go to Yehuda. Yaakov chooses him for leadership because he sees in him the qualities that are needed for leadership. He is strong. He is fearless. He doesn't care if he can stand in front of Reuven and contradict him and say, no, let's not throw him in the pit, or let's take him out of the pit and let's sell him. He faces his father to say, let me be in charge of Binyamin. He faces Yosef and makes Yosef cry. He makes Yosef cry when Yosef, of course, is the second in command in Egypt. He brings him down. And of course, his fearlessness to offer himself. We also see tshuva, the ability to admit to a mistake, chatasi laHashem, the ability to move on past the sin that you've done, to again have Tamar and her children live with him all those years, and of course, fighting to save Binyamin to kind of do tshuva for the fact that he lost Yosef. He has a flaw. It's women issues, that is for sure, and we will see that throughout the tribe of Yehuda, but all of these qualities that I just mentioned, we will see in all the Yehuda characters. And therefore, throughout Tanakh, we are going to find so many of our leaders being Yehuda characters, and they're all going to have this personality of fearlessness, of leadership, of being trustworthy, of being respected. However, what's interesting is for some of them that we hear about that don't necessarily have this quality because we just don't know their story, Chazal will give them this personality. Even if it's not in the text of the Torah, Chazal sees that Yehuda has this personality and attributes it to everybody from Yehuda. I'll give you an example. So first of all, if you start out Yehuda and Tanakh, as we mentioned last time, he, of course, is the leading Degel. He's the leading encampment that we follow in the Midbar. But the first individual that I want to mention here is Nachshon ben Aminadab, who is the Nasi of the tribe of Yehuda in the desert. And we don't know very much about him. We certainly don't. We know his sister marries Aaron, but that's about it. But here in the Gemara Sotam, in source 41, Chaval clearly gives him a Yehuda personality. Who is Nachshon? What made him merit to be the Nasi of Yehuda? V'yara the Amtchila, he jumps into the Amtsa first. Fearlessness, leadership. That's what Chazal gives to our Yehuda character. When it comes to our next one, we don't need Chazal because it's right in the Psukim, his leadership qualities, which is, of course, Kalev ben Yefuna. Kalev ben Yefuna is coming up very soon in the Parsha. When we get to Parsha Shalach, the Meraglim, he is one of the two spies that says good things, but he certainly steps out amongst even Yehoshua. Source 42, by Has Kalev et Ha'am, they're all saying, we don't want to go in, we don't want to go in. Who is the only one who's fearless enough to stand up and say to the Jewish people, we can do this? It is, of course, Kalev. To the extent that God says about him, Ekev haitaruach acheret, he has a different spirit about him. Kalev is just this amazing, amazing character. Not only that, and one of the things I love about Kalev is the fact that he says, we can do it, we can win. What were the Jewish people so scared about? The nations of Canaan are so strong. The nations of Canaan, there are giants there. Well, when we get to Sefer Yehoshua, Kalev is the leader of the tribe of Yehuda. The tribe of Yehuda conquers all of their enemies, conquers almost their entire territory. And the Psukim therefore tell us Kalev himself kills the Bnei Anak, kills the giant. Kalev does exactly what he says, don't be scared. And Kalev is not scared of even the giants. We move on to the son of Kalev by the name of Hor. Hor has a fascinating story because we don't know so much about him. In source 44, we see that Hor is one of the people chosen to hold up Moshe's hands when they're fighting against Amalek. Aaron's on one side, Hor's on the other. And then a second story we have about Hor is that by Matan Torah, when Moshe goes up on the mountain, he says Aaron and Hor are in charge. So, and then Hor disappears in the text. But it doesn't surprise me again that Chazal fills in the blank by giving him a Yehuda personality. What happened to Hor? He saw Ra'achor ben Achoto, this is Rashi quoting a famous midrash, Shaya mochicham behargu. He said to them, don't serve the Egel, right? Don't build an Egel. And what did they do? They killed him. He fearlessly stood up to the mob and they murdered him. He has the personality of Yehuda. Moving along to Bezalel, which is his grandson, who builds the Mishkan, has the wisdom, which is, of course, found in Yehuda as well, to manipulate someone, to be able to do all the things that Yehuda did. He certainly had to be extremely wise and extremely smart. We see that wisdom coming through in Bezalel. Moving along to Sefer Yehoshua, there's a character by the name of Achan. Achan does something bad in Sefer Yehoshua. He's a negative character. He steals from the loot, from the booty from Yericho, which we weren't allowed to take. But the reason why I bring him up here in Source 47 is he's the next character we have in the text that admits Chatasi Lashem. Just like Yehuda admits to his mistakes, so does Achan. He's killed, but he admits to his mistakes. Moving along to Sefer Shoftim, we see that even though during the time of Yehoshua, he's from Ephraim, a Yosef character is in control, and we'll discuss Yosef next week, we move on to back to a Yehuda character. When we come to Source 48, to the time of the judges, the Jewish people turn to Hashem and say, Mi alelanu, who's supposed to rule us? And God chooses once again the tribe of Yehuda. Yehuda Yale, Yehuda's supposed to lead. That's their destiny. That's who they're supposed to be. That's their destiny. Yehuda is supposed to lead. However, just like we saw in Yehuda, that sometimes he doesn't stand up because he's like, I don't want to be the leader. It naturally comes to him, but he doesn't always stand up. Sefer Shoftim is good evidence of that. Because we do have from Sefer Shoftim leaders from Yehuda. We start off the Sefer very strong. Our first leader is Atzniel ben Kenaz, who is from the tribe of Yehuda, that we know that because he's the brother of Kalev. And he is incredibly fitting to a Yehuda character. In Perek Aleph, which I didn't give you on the source sheet, the story we hear about Atzniel is that there's a place called Kiryat Sefer. Nobody wants to conquer it. Even Kalev doesn't want to conquer it. Who's going to conquer this land? Atzniel ben Kenaz gets up and conquers the land. He's fearless. He's a Yehuda character. And therefore, in Shoftim Perek Gimel, he becomes our Shofet. He becomes the Moshiach. He saves us from Kushan Rishatayim El Haram Narayim. He's also described as having Ruach Hashem, like his brother who has Ruach Acheret. He's an incredible, strong, great leader character coming from the tribe of Yehuda, which is very fitting. However, then all of a sudden, Yehuda drops off the map. And even though it's interesting, because in the beginning of the book of Judges, Yehuda conquers all their territories as opposed to everybody else. And therefore, one could argue they didn't have issues, so they didn't have to fight during the time of the book of Judges because they killed out all their enemies, but we do have a lack of leaders coming from Yehuda at that time. We have someone by the name of Ibsan in source number 50, who's already in chapter 12 of the book of Judges. We have a lot of Yosef characters who we'll discuss next week that come up in the middle. Ibsan really doesn't do very much, but what we do have is a mentioning of a family that comes from Yehuda during that time, and that's not found in Sefer Shoftim, but we know it occurs during the time of Sefer Shoftim. It's found in Megillat Rut. Megillat Rut is Vayhi b'Mishpat HaShoftim. It's during the time of Judges. And therefore, Elimelech, Mahlon, Kilio, Naomi coming from the tribe, and Boaz, of course, from the tribe of Yehuda, you see in them a similar storyline to our Yehuda. They have the same traits. They have the same story. It's really quite fascinating. First of all, the Gemara assumes that they were leaders during that time, which again could come from the fact that they're from Yehuda. They're from Beit Lechem Yehuda, which would therefore maybe imply their leadership role. We have the fact, which I find very interesting, that's to say Bava Batra, that the Gemara Bava Batra tells us that possibly Boaz is even a shofet, a judge, and he's really Ibsan, which is a story unto itself. But the storyline itself is very similar, and I gave you a nice chart here so you can actually see it, where the story of Yehuda and Tamar parallels the story of Megillat Rut so clearly, both Yehuda families who have almost the exact same story. We have a family who leaves everybody else, Vayered Yehuda Meitachav to Elimelech, Mahlon, and Kilion, leaving Beit Lechem Yehuda. We have a listing of parents and children. We have a spouse who loses the spouse and two sons. We have two sons who die without any children, therefore requiring Yibum to be done. We have, which I thought was interesting, someone not recognized, Naomi's not recognized by the Jews when she returns, just like Yehuda does not recognize Tamar. We have the correct person who's supposed to do the Yibum refusing, the Ploni Almoni in the story of Rut, and of course Shela in the story of Yehuda and Tamar, and the next relative in line who ends up doing the Yibum, which is of course Boaz and Yehuda. We have some very strange, sketchy type story of Ruth with Boaz and Tamar with Yehuda. We have the men admitting the women are right and they are wrong, Brucha Atla Hashem and said Kami Meni. And of course, from the Yehuda and Tamar story, we get to Peretz. Peretz, who is mentioned at the end of Megillat Rut, Peretz, who takes us to Boaz, who takes us to Obed, who takes us to David itself. The psukim for us parallel these two stories, reminding us that stories and personality traits that happen within one tribe gets passed down to later generations. But before I run out of time, I have to for sure pick, I would say, the two most famous characters from Yehuda, which personify Yehuda 1,000%, which is, of course, David and Shlomo. David and Shlomo probably are two best leaders, our strongest leaders. If you want to talk about fearlessness, I mean, David is probably your number one person, fighting Goliath the giant when he's this little kid with a slingshot that nobody else will fight. But on the same hand, we see he has the same flaw of Yehuda. He has a woman issue. He takes this married woman, Bathsheba, Vaishkavima, and he's with her. But when the prophet comes to his home, he also admits Chatasi LaHashem. And just like Yehuda, who's not sending away Tamar and his children, who keeps them, lives with that embarrassment, so too David, to the extent that he has another child with Bathsheba by the name of Shlomo, and Shlomo becomes the next king. It's almost the exact same storyline here again, messing up with women, admitting the sin, and then continuing on that relationship, and from that relationship gets us to our next in line to get us to our next king. Shlomo, too, I would say, one of the wisest, for sure, the wisest person that we have, builds the Beit HaMikdash, gives us a time of peace. I mean, he is a great, strong, incredible leader personifying the Yehuda characteristic. However, he too messes up when it comes to women, as I gave you here in source 54, where he ends up loving all these women, marrying 1,000 wives, and because of them, they bring Avodah Zarah into the palace. Whether he himself worships the Avodah Zarah, as it does imply in the Psukim, or as Chazal says, it's just that he allows them to worship Avodah Zarah within his home. Certainly, he does something that is very wrong. Vayash Shlomo hara b'nei Hashem. He does something wrong, and he is punished that the Melucha gets split during the time of his son. But what we very clearly see here is the Yehuda personality, the Yehuda characteristic, which goes through all of their family. There is a fearlessness to them. There is a strength to them. I add one more in. Daniel, Hanania, Mishael, and Azariah from Sefer Daniel are also Yehuda characters. And you see that exact personality They are willing to not eat the regular food and to eat the seeds, saying that they're going to be able to be just as healthy. They're thrown into the lion's den, into the furnace, to be able to worship God. Fearless leaders that we have, all coming from the same tribe. And therefore, I take us back to our original question, which is, why did Yehuda get all of this amazing leadership and Reuven did not? And I said to you that it could be the situation is different. It also could be the personality is different. And you see that very clearly just by seeing all the times in Bereishit that we put them up against each other. If you look here in Source 55, as we started out, the way they're born is just different. Reuven is, God saw my torture, maybe now I'm loved. As opposed to Yehuda, which is Hapam Odes Hashem, this time I'm happy. In Source 56, we see the fact that when it comes to Yosef and the treatment of Yosef, Reuven steps up first. He wants to lead. He says, don't kill Yosef, let's throw him in the pit. Then Yehuda steps up, not feeling at all, you know, any hesitation to contradict his older brother, says, let's sell him. By Shmuel Achav, the brothers listen to Yehuda over Reuven. Yehuda is chosen. He's the natural leader over his brothers. We move along Source 57, where both Reuven and Yehuda say to their dad, we'll be in charge of Binyamin. Let us be in charge. However, of course, Yaakov says no to Reuven, says yes to Yehuda. The personality difference between them, the way people view them, the way they are seen by their father, by their brothers, is so incredibly different. Yehuda has the leadership skills, everything that Reuven is lacking. And therefore, it's not a surprise when we return to Source 58, a pasuk we read last week. Reuven, he's the Bechor, but he messes up. He just doesn't have what it takes to be the leader. He Yehuda gavar be'achav v'nagid mimenu. Yehuda is the one that is stronger. Yehuda is the one that has the leadership qualities. Yehuda is the one who becomes the leader instead of Reuven. He's the natural leader. He has everything about him that is perfect for leadership. But you might say, what do you mean? He had a story where he clearly sins. He has a story over and over again where we see imperfection. And I think what's very clear by all the stories in Tanakh, but specifically the Yehuda characters, is that we can't assume leaders are perfect, because there's no person alive that's perfect. We are human. We are not God. We are not Malachim. We are not perfect. But I think the reason that Yehuda gets to be the leader at the end of the day is because he never lets a sin or an imperfection stop him in his tracks. He sees it, he admits to it, which takes tremendous strength, and then he moves forward from it. And those are two different qualities that I think are something to learn from Yehuda, which is not just to admit, but to also move forward. And the only way you can move forward is to forgive yourself, to say, I deserve to move forward. I deserve to continue to lead the family and to be the person that I'm meant to be, to try to continue to move on after a major failure in my life. And I think that's really the lesson of Yehuda. You see, Reuven was stuck. He wanted to lead. He kept getting kicked down. And therefore, he was just stuck in the rut of being something that he wasn't meant to be. But when it comes to Yehuda, that's not how Yehuda worked. Yehuda said, you know what? I had a flaw. I had a low moment in my life. Again, whether it's a moment of immorality or just a low moment of sadness, I pick myself up. I say, Chatasi, I messed up. And then I'm going to spend the rest of my life doing tshuva. I'm going to protect Binyamin the way I didn't protect Yosef. I'm going to lead my family in the right way this time, as opposed to the way I led them the first time. I'm not going to let my past get me down. And I think for that is what deserved the leadership of Yehuda. Yes, it's his qualities of fearlessness and able to be trustworthy and respected and listened to by others, but it's also his ability to stop himself, see a flaw, admit to it, and move on from it. And I think that's something very, very powerful for all of us to learn from Yehuda, to forgive ourselves when we do something wrong, and to move on from the mistakes that we make to become even better people. That is the beauty of Yehuda. Again, I apologize so, so much for all the issues that we had in the beginning. I hope you were all still able to enjoy this year, and hopefully we will get it all fixed before next week when we will be doing Yosef.